You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host from Newark, Delaware, Bill Humphrey.
From 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you this February 11th, 2013, from the University of Delaware. Ahead this hour, Sasha and I discuss Pope Benedict's resignation, President Obama's new push for denuclearization, young America's attitudes toward government, and American policy in Syria. All this and more just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show locally on 91.3 FM WVUD and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us your thoughts and reactions at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Hi, I'm Bill Humphrey, and this is the Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me again this week is our guest commentator, Sasha. How are you this week, Sasha?
I'm good. How are you, Bill?
Good. Well, let's start with the huge story that's making all the headlines today. Pope Benedict XVI announced his resignation effective February 28th from the papacy of the Catholic Church in the Vatican in Rome. And this is causing quite a bit of a stir, in large part because nobody's resigned from being pope since the 1400s. And that was Gregory XII resigned in 1415, and then he lived for 2 years in solitude so that no one could ask him his opinion on papal matters, and they also didn't replace him. So there was not really any question. It was basically they just waited for him to die, and so, you know, who knows whether it even mattered that he actually resigned. And there's been some people before that who resigned. Back in the day, there was a lot of confusion sometimes over who was actually the pope. There'd be rival people proclaiming rival popes and all that. So this is a pretty big deal because this was also unexpected to the point where the press secretary or whatever the equivalent name is in the Vatican had a press conference and more or less said that he had no idea that this was coming and hadn't done any advanced planning and had to bring out a copy of the canon law with him. Almost 3 years ago, there was a long piece by Daniel Walken in the New York Times, and it was titled "Do Popes Quit?" And this was prompted initially by some discussion over the fact that Benedict, when he was Archbishop Ratzinger in Munich, had possibly improperly handled the abuse allegations in that diocese, archdiocese, and there was some question over whether or not he should resign over that. Now, that hasn't really happened. We are told that in the official statement that the Pope is resigning for health reasons. You know, who knows? Maybe there's something big, like an undiagnosed illness or some huge scandal that was going to break or something like that. But it's distinctly possible, since he's 85, that he may just want to resign. And he actually, another reason that this discussion had been brought up again once he had been pope for a few years was that he had been one of the people in the Vatican administration under John Paul II who had made the argument that popes legally could resign and should probably consider it as an option if they became unfit to continue holding office. And this was something that John Paul had mentioned a few times as well himself. He did end up passing away in 2005, so it didn't become an issue, but he was not doing well by the end, and there was some question about, you know, what would happen if, for example, he didn't resign, but he also didn't die, but he went into a coma. You know, then he couldn't sign that he was resigning or anything like that. But then, you know, how would things go on? So this article came up, and it was less of a question of should Benedict resign over any of the various complaints that some people had with him, but it was more a question of what would the legal procedure be, and could he resign? So at least two of the official popes have resigned before. And like I said, there were some maybe unofficial popes or rival claimants who may have abdicated at some point. But the most recent one was Gregory the 12th in 1415. And the reason that he did that was there was this thing called the Western Schism, also known as the Papal Schism. And it was a split that was in the late 1300s, early 1400s within the Western part of the church, that is the Catholic Church. And there were two people claiming that they were Pope at the same time. And so they needed to resolve that situation. And as part of the resolution to that, Gregory the 12th stepped down or abdicated the position of the Pope. But again, because he didn't actually ever get replaced in the time, you know, in the 2 years before he died and he was not in the scene, there wasn't really, you know, any sort of dispute over who might actually be in charge. However, the problem that was raised by this article back in April of 2010 was that with popes living to be older and older these days, kind of like all our other world leaders, there might be some serious questions as to the legitimacy of a new pope if one was elected, but the one who had resigned had not passed away yet, which would be the case here, assuming that Benedict doesn't pass away in the next, you know, few months. And in 1415, they weren't sure whether or not he still had the force of all the doctrinal powers of the pope, but it didn't really end up becoming that much of an issue. However, right now, a former pope would still retain a lot of his followers and have a lot of support, especially from the cardinals who had elected him. And it's unlikely that Benedict is going to just disappear into solitude like a 15th century Gregory. So then that raises the question of if he makes some public statement, is he speaking, you know, as the voice of the church? What if he contradicts something that the new pope says? That leads to some, you know, disputes over the power. Now, normally with a, you know, a democratic system or something like that, obviously once a new person is sworn in, that's it. But that's a temporal political thing. This would be bringing in spiritual, religious dimensions, etc., that obviously aren't really governed by the rule of law in the way that obviously once Nixon resigned, he didn't get to make presidential decisions for Ford. You know, that was never an issue. But it would be, you know, so if you had a situation where a former U.S. president started just criticizing everything that the current president was doing, that would probably be annoying. But it wouldn't have the force of any law or power behind it. It would just be kind of a ranting old man. And that's not the situation here. So that could potentially be an issue. And this is why it had come up before John Paul II passed away, of trying to figure out what the actual rules were for this. And Ratzinger, who is now Pope Benedict, was one of the cardinals in the Vatican saying that resignation is an option. It's a legal option. He had even mentioned it for himself because, again, at the time that he was elected, he was already older than Pope John Paul II had been when he passed away. The idea here was to put him in for a short period of time, then have another election. But the assumption was that he would pass away and probably not resign. But obviously, he had some other ideas about this, and you know, maybe he's just tired and wants to move on. But, you know, it seems pretty likely that in this situation, I think we can anticipate, like, he would probably write and publish a book. That seems kind of like something that anybody else in this situation would do. And then the question is he allowed to do that? Does that book now have the force of everything? Does he have to wait until he's dead before it can be published? So, you know, because at this point, it's standard course for anybody in these positions to get their memoirs published or anything like that. Pope John Paul II actually back in 1996 came up with some new papal succession rules, and he referred to the death or valid resignation of the pope. But then the question is, valid resignation has never really been defined. So what potentially is, you know, is this a valid resignation just because the pope says, hey, I'm resigning, by the way, you know, on February 28th? Now, the other big thing that's being brought up by this is, well, for one thing, some people seem to be a little bit panicky here. That is a bit puzzling to me. I mean, maybe I just am not in the situation, so I don't understand it. But I think, you know, this is not cause for any concern. This is an institution that has gone on for many, many years, thousands of years. It's going to survive something like this without any trouble. And if he had died, I think it would have been the same thing. It just, you know, so there's no crisis here. You know, people already starting to speculate on who's likely to be called up, elected by the conclave to replace him. There's been a lot of talk about maybe it will be an African cardinal. I think that seems like, you know, or possibly a Latin American cardinal, but an African cardinal is certainly would be an interesting option. And I think that the from a sort of political or directional standpoint, it allows the church to put a new face in front of a lot of the problems facing the church without actually having a huge doctrine shift, because it's not like putting some young progressive person in. It's very likely that it would be a fairly conservative person. But they might put more focus on coming up with humanitarian solutions to problems in the third world or the global south in general. So I think that's going to be something interesting to keep an eye on as we move forward. But the Pope can legally resign, but they probably should have done a little bit more legal clarification before he sprang this on everyone. But he went ahead and did it anyway, so there it is. And that's just sort of my personal opinion on this. Sasha, did you have any thoughts on any of this or any comments on some of the reaction that you've been following today?
I'm not really surprised, to be honest, especially after you mentioned that it's something that he thought was definitely legal for a pope to do. I don't think anyone really wants to spend their dying days, I don't know, in front of large amounts of people. I mean, some people might, but I think it's just, it doesn't really surprise me at all that he would resign rather than continuing to deteriorate as the Pope. What's more entertaining is people's reactions on, like, the Twitterverse, which a lot of people have been reporting how many jokes
and
you can go through.
If you're uncomfortable with mild and tasteful jokes about the resignation of a pope, and you might want to skip this next part. But
I don't think it's mild. The Fix said Pope Benedict, following Sarah Palin's lead, resigns. But I think he might have gotten a little feedback on that, because he said, "Today I learned you can't joke about the Pope." Got it. So, I mean, you know, people always give the Pope a hard time, mostly because they don't really adjust to change as quickly. But the Pope was one of the first he was the first Pope on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I
was speculating earlier today that he may have just, you know, he threw out a few tweets in Latin and then just decided, nope, can't handle this 21st century world. Nope, I can't deal with this.
He only tweeted like 30 times in the month
and
a
half,
2 months he had
it. I have to boil everything down to 140 characters. Hashtag, I'm out.
That's exactly what he did. And then exit stage right to resignation, I guess.
Yeah.
That's what he did.
Any other interesting reactions to this situation?
People have been nominating people for Pope, such as Hillary Clinton and Obama. They've also asked if he's going to now be a candidate for the Massachusetts Senate race.
We talked about that last week, of course. He'd be running as an independent, I guess, and definitely isn't legally allowed to, but under this scenario would probably be running as an independent, which, you know, might be helpful for some of the conservatives in the state, because they, to update everyone on that situation, pretty much all the front-running Republicans are out. So Scott Brown's out, Bill Weld is out, Kerry Healy's out, and now we're down just to people that no one's ever heard of. So, you know, that's an option.
The last one I really liked was, "Has Nate Silver predicted the next pope already?" by Ben Jacobs. So we'll see. Maybe he will.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if Nate Silver dipped his finger in that too.
It's definitely tricky to predict. It's not a very open process, considering that they scan everyone's pens to make sure there aren't microphones getting inside where the election is. Now is always a good time to remind everyone that the CIA World Factbook has one of the most entertaining pages possible for the Vatican, because they basically break down all the statistics that they do for all the regular countries, and then have like weird requirements and restrictions put in, like suffrage is extended to cardinals under the age of 80. So that's universal suffrage for all cardinals under the age of 80. And various other statistics like that. For those who need their ATM needs met in Latin, you can also go to an ATM in the Vatican. I was interested. I thought it was interesting that the Pope came out and announced in Latin as usual. I guess they scrambled to get translations out pretty quickly for the media, but I wonder if there was some real old school journalist who had done his Latin homework a long time ago and figured out what was happening before everyone else did. I can't have had a very big impact on the actual crowd listening to the speech, though, because they would have had no idea what they were hearing. Such a momentous announcement. But again, pretty big news. Things will go on. It'll be interesting to see if they turn the corner on anything with the next selection. So that's the big story of the day. The State of the Union is coming up for President Obama to switch back to domestic policy. And there was a few points that I wanted to touch on that. So one of the major points of the State of the Union address this year is apparently going to be, as the New York Times headline put it, a renewed drive for cuts in nuclear arms. And so for background, in 2010, over the course of 2009 and then into 2010, President Obama and the Russian government successfully negotiated a new strategic arms reduction agreement, sometimes referred to as New START, which was an agreement on reduction of nuclear arsenals. And after much protestation over the entire course of 2010 from some of the Senate Republicans, it finally passed ratification with 71 senators supporting during the 2010 lame duck session. I'm very well known as a big advocate for denuclearization and reduction of nuclear weapons, and neither Russia nor the United States needs anywhere near the size of the arsenal of nuclear weapons that both countries have. And this is definitely a goal that President Obama has been working on since he was in the U.S. Senate. He was involved with Senator Lugar of Indiana. Well, I should say former senator, because he lost his primary last year, as we covered on this show. And that was actually part of why Lugar lost his primary, was that he had, been a moderate statesman on many of these issues that, should be nonpartisan, about how can we both reduce nuclear arsenals and how can we control arsenals in every nuclear country so that these don't get into the wrong hands. And that was something that a number of senators had worked on before President Obama had gotten into the Senate, and then they've continued to work on it to some extent after he left. And that was one of the reasons that, people had pointed out when he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, some people were saying, oh, look, he hasn't done anything as president yet. But a lot of people are saying, but he did actually do some very valuable work with that on when he was in the U.S. Senate on denuclearization, on loose nukes controls. And as president, he made that a very clear priority in foreign policy toward the beginning. It sort of shifted away as the Congress was a little bit less cooperative and as other things like the Arab Spring came up that sort of dominated the attention. But the Treaty of Prague, I think, was the alternate name for the START Treaty, and that was named in part because President Obama launched this push for a new round of denuclearization talks in Prague in the Czech Republic, and has been pushing for this. And I think that it's great to see this coming back up on the agenda once again. Very exciting to see this happening. I don't know how much success it's going to meet with. But the Democrats are in a better position in the U.S. Senate now than they were a couple years ago. The United States would be cutting, under this agreement, would be cutting their nuclear arsenal down to just 1,000 nuclear weapons.
Only.
Only. And those are deployed weapons. So we would, at any given point, have over 1,000 nuclear weapons ready to go at any moment, and that's after these cuts come into place. Right now, we're at 1,700, so that's 1,700 opportunities to annihilate a small city, a large city, a country, or you know, any number of circumstances where they could be used. They would be trying to. There would be similar reductions on the Russian side. Additionally, the reductions will actually save a lot of money, according to the Obama administration. And they made clear that it won't, quote, compromise American security in the second term. Obviously, it's not going to compromise American security to reduce our nuclear arsenal from 1,700 actively deployed nuclear weapons to over 1,000, really. And it looks like they probably won't be renegotiating. But it says that the issue here is that the Senate, they had gotten the treaty through, but they hadn't actually gotten the cuts approved. I guess there was maybe a two-part process there that they technically agreed to have these reductions happen, but then didn't actually legalize the reductions or, you know, cut the funding for them or whatever they need to do to make those reductions happen. And they the Obama administration does not want to renegotiate a new treaty because that would lead to, they're saying, according to this New York Times article, would lead to calls for restrictions on American and NATO missile defense systems in Europe. And they just don't want to have another fight with the Senate. So that's why President Obama is trying to get to an informal agreement with Vladimir Putin on mutual cuts within the framework. And this is, again, according to the New York Times reporting yesterday on this. So that's going to be one of the themes on the State of the Union. Of course, another thing that's been coming up is the one that I talked at length about last week about cyber warfare policies. Another big theme that is coming up in the State of the Union, apparently, is the role of government as a force for good. And the New York Times did an article yesterday as well on kind of looking at this theme and particularly how our generation, the millennial generation, reacts to this. And this is something that we've talked about many, many times on this show before. But consistently, the Pew Research polling has shown again and again that this generation is different from a lot of the other generations, both currently and at past points when they were our age, in terms of our views on big government, that we have the most positive attitudes toward government as a force for good, as something that can solve some of these national problems. And that's something that is a big shift since you'd have to go back to really the generation that was growing up around the time of FDR and World War II. And according to the Pew Research Center, they said under 30 voters are the only age group in which a majority said the government should do more to fix problems as opposed to less. And they said that more than 8 in 10 said they believed that Social Security and Medicare had been good for the country, and they were supportive of seeing the programs overhauled so that they would continue to be there when it was time for them to retire. They are somewhat more open to some of the privatization proposals, but I think that gets a little bit into the weeds in terms of things that most average Americans, regardless of their generation, probably don't know necessarily what details are the best to make those programs have the most stability and be around. A lot of them also saying, you know, education reform is a big thing. Local government tends to be favored as well. You know, which you'd think that the Republicans would manage to tap in on that, but they're kind of on the whole anti-government kick the whole time, hasn't really helped them. And so the New York Times article was talking about some of the issues here is that the Republicans are really starting to lose their opportunity to pick up any millennials. And what typically happens with these is that if there are three presidential election cycles where a generation has just started voting and they break consistently a certain way, that's pretty much locked in permanently. So the generation, the greatest generation that would have been coming of age right in, you know, in the Depression period or around World War II, those people locked in as Democrats pretty much permanently. The Reagan generation, those people, they were growing up at the height of the Reagan Revolution, turning 18, pulling that lever, you know, for Reagan twice and then George H.W. Bush, they're also locked in as Republicans. And we've talked about before, that generation in particular tends to be especially cynical of government and that kind of thing. And that goes back to when they were 18, 20, you know, even 30. That was not – there's that there's really obnoxious phrase about how people are, you know, that you're younger when you're liberal – and then you're conservative when you're older, because they have the phrase about if you're young and conservative, you have no heart, and if you're old and liberal, you have no head. That's stupid and also doesn't actually hold true for, like, any of the – like, you can look at these. It really is more of a function of who's in power and appeals to those young people at the time that they're becoming active in the political process. So there are generations that are a lot more conservative, and they start out as conservative and remain conservative. They don't become more conservative as they get older. It happens right now that a lot of those people who are more conservative are starting to hit that especially politically powerful period, you know, the retirees age, that sort of arena. A lot of them are fairly conservative, but many of them were conservative for their entire lives. That's not something that they became conservative as soon as they hit retirement and started collecting Social Security checks. This generation has been pretty solidly locked in as being pretty exceptionally liberal, especially on the role of government. And that seems to be in large part a function of the attacks on September 11th. There was obviously a pretty big governmental response after that, but that, you know, that they had more feelings of patriotism and volunteerism and just a more cooperative sense in general, and seeing the government less as an enemy and more as a force for something that can do good. And a lot of the consultants for the Republicans are finding that their message of being totally stridently against the government is not resonating very well with our generation, because our generation's not actually that skeptical of the government as a potential force for good. Now, obviously, the president is going to strike that theme of we can do better about having the government's work on some of these problems, that we can have better governance, have the government be a force for good, that the government's not always a force for good. But again, there are ways to do it better, and our generation is fully on board with that as well, I think. You know, there's a lot of problems that can be tackled. For example, the Republicans, especially under George W. Bush, spent many, many years trying to make the argument that if the private sector could do it, the private sector should do it, and the government should spin it off. The result of that was that instead of having a large civil service corps of people who are directly employees of the government and that sort of thing, you have much more expensively paid with less oversight private federal contractors. That number grew dramatically especially under the Bush administration. And you really have to ask yourself, why would you pay with public money, government funds, to a private company to do something if you could do it through the government? And the argument that the conservatives are always making is this weird argument that, like, oh, all government employees are just inherently somehow terrible at their jobs or something in a way that private sector employees aren't. That really doesn't make any sense. Part of the issue, of course, is that the government tends to pay people a lot less to work in government to do the same jobs that they would be getting than what they would be getting paid if they did those jobs in the private sector. Again, it seems like the reaction there is not to outsource it to the private sector, but to streamline it, have it all in one place, bring it in-house. It seems to me that if you have the government doing things in-house, it's going to tend to be a lot more efficient, there's going to be a lot fewer middlemen, and you're going to cut down on that bureaucracy. For all the talk about, oh, the bureaucracy is so evil and all that kind of thing, that's not actually the issue here. The issue is the bureaucracy is not coming from the public employees in the civil service of all those people in Northern Virginia and Southern Maryland and Washington, D.C. The problem is all those federal contractors in those places, which is not necessarily a knock against them. But the fact is, if you have, you know, a government agency to work on something, and then the government agency outsources it, there's now a parallel structure in the private company that they've outsourced it to. And now you have to have all those people coordinate things on top of all the interagency coordination and things like that. You really need to, if you want the government to work better, you have to streamline the government, not add more layers by putting things outside of the government functions. So there are ways to make the government work better for the American people, but a lot of people in our generation feel that the government is a potential force for good that can be harnessed. in part if we stop fighting it constantly and stop trying to defund it, because that's been, you know, it's not like, you know, some conspiracy theory. It's been an avowed policy of the Republicans for quite some time now, especially under Grover Norquist, of basically if you defund a program, then it'll stop happening. Like, you'll have to stop the program. Because, surprise, if you defund a government agency or program, it doesn't work very well. So there are ways to make the government better, and I hope that the president strikes this theme in the State of the Union. I think it would go very well with his much more progressive inaugural address. Sasha, I wanted to get your thoughts on some of these themes and kind of how you, what you're kind of hoping to hear from the president on this topic.
Well, a lot of what you said I do agree with. I definitely think that this younger generation has taken to heart what President Obama has said about government being able to support us and our student needs and that sort of thing. I mean, everything he's done with universal health care and student loans has always been to help our generation and to actually see us be more successful. And I think they've really taken that to heart, that it's not something that they have to do by themselves. The government is there to assist you to grow and get, and to, I mean, eventually achieve those opportunities that we're, I mean, that we're all trying to get. You know what I mean? The point,
yeah,
we're all trying to get there. It's not something you just have to continuously work towards without having a little bit of help. And it's not bad. It's not a bad thing. And I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with, is there's nothing wrong with having help.
I think that's a really excellent point, too, that these, you know, these haven't been, the Republicans, especially in the last election, tried to frame these as some sort of handouts for college students, basically, to help fire up the base. But the thing is, these are not handouts. It's not a, it would be a handout if you just gave free health care to everyone, you know, under 26. But no, they said you get to stay on your parents' health insurance so that you can be looking for a job or taking that job that doesn't have health benefits but not worrying about your health, so that you can get, you know, a little bit of money together, figure out your career path, get something that'll be help you get on your feet in your career more long term. That that's not a handout. That's, as you said, it's helping you get there. The same thing with student loan reform. That's another area where they took out all the federal contractors. You take out the middleman. You've got less bureaucracy. You do it in-house. You save money. Pass those savings on to those students. Now those students have a slightly easier time of getting on their feet, launching their careers, becoming productive American citizens, who then pay taxes, of course, and continue, you know, to pay that back to the government and provide, you know, resources for everyone else coming behind them. This is not a system of handouts. This is a way of making the government work better for people, particularly young people, so that they can in turn make the country better and make the society stronger.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for putting that into much nicer words for me there, but I completely agree. And it seems like there's this stigma that it is a handout, when really it's just a helping hand. It's just something to help them get back on their feet, to make sure they can get on their feet. You know what I mean? A lot of people are graduating from college and a bachelor's degree isn't enough anymore. People want master's degrees and PhDs and that sort of thing. And it's hard to do that when you have crippling student debt and you can't afford to do that, and you can't afford your own health insurance and that sort of thing. And it's hard, and I don't think that they recognize that, because they come from this generation where they weren't helped. And so they kind of reject that idea because they weren't. They didn't get that help they needed, and so the idea of helping other, you know what I mean?
Well,
Does that make sense?
One thing that we talked about on an episode that I think you were in London at the time that we were doing that episode, but we had a long episode talking about the kind of the differences of the generations not understanding each other on a much more fundamental level than the usual generation gaps, that it's just a totally different, inconceivable experience. You know, for many, many years, it was the most normal thing in the world that you would finish your schooling and then go back and move in with your parents, you know, either stay with them permanently, and that's where your, you know, your new household would start, or you would eventually move out once you had, you know, gotten through those tough early years. It happened that there were maybe two generations, like the baby boomers and the Gen Xers, who got very lucky in that the economy was growing at a fast enough pace at the time that they were leaving school and leaving college for many of them, or some of them were even able to get jobs without a college degree, which, of course, is not an option for many Americans these days. And they graduated at a time when they could get right on their feet right away, go right into the workforce, make enough money to live on their own without having to live with their parents. And so for them, that became the new normal. But that was never a normal situation. And now they look, you know, very negatively in many cases on people in our generation having to continue to rely on our older generation, our parents, our grandparents, that kind of thing, even though the job opportunities are really limited out there for many of us. And it's starting to get better as the economy turns around. And we can definitely see the light at the end of the tunnel. But for many people, that has been very difficult. And the idea here is let's solve all your problems. It's let's help make this a little bit better so that you can get out there and succeed so that you're not coming out, 5 years after the recession started and you've had almost no work experience. You haven't, you've had health problems, things like that, things that are permanently going to set you back earnings wise compared to everyone else, experience wise compared to those people who are graduating, newly at the time that you finally make it into the workforce, that it's recognizing that times have been tough, that we had several decades where things were going great for a lot of people, and we're now back to a different situation. There are things that we can do to make that better, but in the short term, we need to be able to give people a helping hand so that they can get out there and start to succeed.
Yeah, so I mean, to bring that full circle, I think that's essentially where that our generation is at. I mean, President Obama has given us those opportunities. He's made it clear that he respects that idea that we should have a helping hand, that times are tough, the recession put us back, it's hard to graduate with a bachelor's degree and just jump right into the workforce. It's not really realistic at this time. And so I think that's where he's pulling a lot of those people in, and they're agreeing, and that's natural. And I think, yeah, that's what we're going to hear from him tomorrow, and I think he's going to have a lot of support from our generation.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. Now, another thing that I wanted to touch briefly on with regard to the State of the Union. So President Obama giving the State of the Union, typically there's a Republican response or a response from the minority party or the opposing party. And Marco Rubio, probably unsurprisingly, was chosen to give the Republican response. However, I saw a little blurb in the New York Times that said that Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, everyone's favorite unlicensed ophthalmologist turned United States senator, would be giving the, quote, Tea Party response. Now, Sasha, are we still doing that as a country? Is that a thing we still do?
I was really surprised when you mentioned that to me, because I think the Tea Party isn't exactly on the forefront of anyone's mind right now. The Republican Party has been actively talking about how they need to revamp, and I don't think the Tea Party is a part of those discussions at all. I think they're in fact something that has been making the Republican Party weaker, and so the fact that the Tea Party is having a response to the State of the Union is quite surprising and should be definitely entertaining and interesting from Rand Paul.
I'm just confused. Like, why are we still doing that? This seems so irrelevant, and it was such a goofy, like, stunt to do before. Why is it still happening?
Before, they were a little more, they were at the start of whatever, the beginning. It was exciting, I guess you could say, because it's something new. But now I think they've kind of reached that sort of irrelevance that people are kind of sick of their shenanigans. And I mean, that's what they are, shenanigans. And
yeah, I don't intend to. I never watch the Republican responses anyway. My question is, why can't we get Bobby Jindal to come out and do another disastrous response talking like Mr. Rogers about something called volcano monitoring and just like really just not doing well? Of course, he's on his whole kick about stupid Republicans and that's his thing. And then, of course, probably unsurprisingly getting quite a bit of criticism about referring to his own party as being the stupid party. Real unclear on his whole plan for how that was supposed to play out, but that's really beside the point. Now, let's just take a few minutes, close out on a different subject, going more to the foreign policy territory. One of the other big things that has been happening recently is that the United States Senate had a hearing about the U.S. policy in Syria. And this was led by, well, a lot of the questioning was led by John McCain and Lindsey Graham. And it was primarily focused on Secretary of Defense, outgoing Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, and General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And basically, John McCain, as we know, has been going on and on this whole time about how he would like the U.S. to take military action in Syria. This is not something that's supported by the American people. It's also not supported by a lot of the experts in even both within the administration, outside of the administration. Very few people think that it would be a particularly good idea for the United States to intervene, because this is not Libya. This would not be a quick operation with minimal involvement. It's a lot more like Iraq, of a pretty big geographical area to deal with in terms of the population spread. Not an ideal terrain. It's a great place to get bogged down for another 20 years or whatever, and lose a lot of lives. John McCain's been going on and on and on and on and on about how he would like military action in Syria. And in particular, he was complaining because Leon Panetta and Martin Dempsey testified that they had been in favor of a plan proposed by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and CIA Director David Petraeus, talking about how they wanted to arm certain rebels in Syria. Now, a lot of the leaks at the time had indicated that this was actually already happening. Apparently, has not happened. President Obama opposed this when many of the security advisors were in favor of it. Some of them making the argument that this is going to be eventually the Assad regime will fall, and whoever has guns, this was one quote that I saw, whoever has the guns is going to be the one in power, which to me sounds like an argument not to be arming people, because that's a pretty bad way of choosing the next government of a, you know, basically who has more guns. But then, you know, the line of reasoning there was, well, at least they'll owe us for those guns as opposed to owing some other group like Al-Qaeda or China or whoever is arming. I don't think China's arming them, but, you know, who knows these days? It's very hard to tell who's arming who in that situation. It's a very messy conflict. John McCain was very, very upset that 60,000 Syrians had died in the fighting and that there hadn't been military action yet. And specifically, he and Lindsey Graham were very upset that that President Obama had opposed arming these groups. I think that the president probably made the right call in that situation. In part, he didn't want to have this turn into a giant mess right before the election, which you could make the argument, oh, well, that's self-serving because he didn't want to affect his chances in the election. But again, this was a pretty close election, especially there were some times throughout the year where it looked like it could be very close and could go either way. And it's not really fair to the other guy, Mitt Romney in this case, to potentially be dumping that on him if he ended up winning the election. So it's better to leave this, especially if it's not like a situation where you can see a clear mission, a clear way to win. My general position that I usually advocate on these things is that I typically do favor military interventions in humanitarian situations to prevent, you know, large-scale massacres or bring some terrible situations to an end. But again, this is a very complex and messy civil war. Yes, we're opposed to one side, but the other side did not really have its act together for most of this. And if you're going to do one of these things, you have to be able to win to go in. So the two rules that I typically use when assessing one of these situations is, does the United States have the capacity to act in the situation? Do we have the troops available, et cetera? That's becoming more of an option than, say, it was with the Darfur situation, because we're no longer bogged down in Iraq to the extent that we were, although we do still have troops in Afghanistan. And the second point is, in addition to the capacity, do we have the ability to achieve concrete objectives and then not leave a giant mess or get stuck there? And I think that was not fully ever resolved. Any particular thoughts on this and whether or not the president made a good call, or what you think of John McCain's rather angry reactions?
I think John McCain and Lindsey Graham, for that matter, have this emphasis on military power that is not necessary all the time, and I feel like that's their usual resort. They automatically go towards military, and it might just be because, I mean, for John McCain, like, he's from that background. But I think in general, especially in cases with Syria, we need to be a little bit more cautious about putting boots on the ground. There's a lot of different ways that we can influence what's happening and maybe help the situation in, you know, the rebels' favor without actually getting directly involved. And I think Obama made the good call there. He was, you know, with Libya, for example, he was taking a risk. It worked out in the end for him. But I think Syria is a lot more complicated than Libya was. And so definitely needs to proceed with caution.
And I think an interesting you know, tie into this, of course, is the Mali situation that I've been covering for several weeks now on the show. You know, excellent timing for this to happen from this, you know, the context of this debate. Of course, terrible for it to have happened for the French. But the French had basically taken all of the major towns in the north where they were fighting these Islamist rebels. And they had the Malian army there with them, too, although the Malian army is not terribly competent at their jobs or life in general. But then, of course, as you know, right as many people had predicted, was probably a big concern in the city of Gao. These Islamists who had been pushed out struck back today on Monday and basically tried to take back control of the city and, you know, waged a guerrilla war or launched a guerrilla attack in this situation. And I think that shows you the risk of if you make one of these brief interventions, you know, how brief is it really, especially once you have boots on the ground? Are you potentially committing yourself to a long, dragged-out conflict in the middle of nowhere that is, you know, you can see the arguments for going in, but do you have the capacity to succeed? Because France had the capacity to carry out the operation, but are they going to succeed in it? What are the parameters of it? What happens if they leave? Is this a permanent solution, or is it just a temporary sort of, you know, they get the, beat them back for a month or two, pull out all their troops, and then the situation reverts back to how it was pre-invasion, and then you've spent all that money and potentially lost lives. So I think that this is, you know, that's a bit of a cautionary tale. Hopefully it plays out a little bit better than that, but you know, that I think is interesting that that happened as this debate was resurfacing on U.S. Policy in Syria. Well, Sasha, thank you so much for joining me again this week on Arsenal for Democracy. And we'll definitely get you back on again soon.
Thanks, Phil.
Well, that's all for this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for February 11th, 2013. The show is usually recorded at the University of Delaware Perkins Center every Monday and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Monday nights. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man Justin and my guest commentator Sasha. From the WVUD studios in Newark, Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.